and welcome to the Clever Tax Podcast, Creating Useful People. I'm Jodie Cook, and today I'm joined by one of my smartest friends, Jeremy Walker. Jeremy is a geek and an entrepreneur. He runs a range of technology businesses, ranging from an education platform that's helped over 200,000 people learn to code, to using artificial intelligence to improve outcomes during heart surgery. After knowing Jeremy for a very long time, I've been fascinated with some of his childhood stories, and I'm excited to be able to share these with you now. So, Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's get straight into it. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
So, I knew you were going to ask me this question to start with. It's the only thing I know about this. And it's such a broad question, I feel like I could just talk for days about it. So please feel free to shut me up if you find that I am actually talking for days about it. I would start off by saying I had a very happy childhood, which I'm sure my mum will be pleased to hear. I come from a very religious family. I'm very much not religious now. So there's an interesting, I guess, journey that occurred during that. I came from a family that had very little financial wealth. I grew up on benefits and on handouts for a while. I also grew up with a dad who, I think from, I don't know the exact age, about five, was disabled with very arthritic knees and had to stop working. He didn't really leave the house for most of my childhood, which I guess was an unusual experience. I guess I was blessed with having some intelligence when I was growing up and ended up going to quite a good secondary school especially, which was definitely an important part of shaping who I am today. That's a quick overview in about 10 different vectors that we could talk down. I'll let you decide which one of those vectors you want to explore.
So much. So talk to you about the religious upbringing then. What was that like day to day?
We weren't allowed electricity on Sundays. I think that's, if I could sum my childhood up in one memory, that would be a very big part of it. So my dad, before I was born, was a Baptist minister and quite a strict Baptist minister. And my parents got married, I think, about a year before I was born. And my dad had given up preaching for various reasons and was just trying to make ends meet in other ways. But I guess a lot of my childhood was rooted in church, in a very religious Christian community. And a lot of the morals and the backbone of probably who I am has been very heavily shaped by that upbringing. I think that sort of upbringing gave me a huge sense of love and community and wanting to do good and wanting to care for people. That didn't prepare me for the real world in some ways as well. But when you grow up, you don't know that your situation's different or the same to anyone else's. So you just are who you are. And I was very fortunate to have some, you know, really great friends in that Christian community as well. My best friend still, he's gone the very opposite direction to me and gone on to be a vicar. He's still very much in that Christian world, but it certainly shaped a lot of who I am.
What age were you when you started to think, maybe this religion thing isn't going to be a part of my future?
I was at university. So I guess I was like the ultimate Bible basher all through my school days. I would have argued to the grave that the world was like 6,000 years old when I was probably still 17, 18. But I got to university and I was on I did computer science and artificial intelligence, and I was at Birmingham, which is a very mixed race place. But I was on a course with, I think, about 450 people, of whom three were female and about 10 of us weren't Muslim. And so I had, like, everyone on my course that I was interacting with were Muslim, and especially at Birmingham, it's a pretty serious place for, like, the Islamic Society is the largest society on campus. People take it very seriously. So I got a lot of exposure for the first time to a different religion. And so a lot of my time in computer labs in the computer science building was spent debating Christianity versus Islam with these people in a very friendly way, but also, I guess, quite a knowledgeable way. And I think the thing that struck me was that I was absolutely convinced I was right. They were absolutely convinced that they were right. We had as much, or maybe I should say as little, evidence as each other that we were right, and a total impasse. And that was the thing that jolted me, was thinking, well, actually, arguing religion versus non-religion, it's a very different type of argument to arguing religion versus religion, where suddenly you have to question, what is it that makes me so sure when these people aren't so sure? You know, I can quote the Bible and they can quote the Quran, but neither of us have got much evidence beyond that. Then I decided that either we were both right, which was impossible because both of our belief systems were very clear that we couldn't be right and the other one had to be wrong, or we were both wrong. And so just by logical deduction, I was clearly wrong. So therefore, I stopped being a Christian.
And Jeremy being wrong is not something that often happens.
My mantra for life is having very strong opinions, very loosely held. So I tend to fight tooth and nail for any thought that I've come up with about half an hour later. But if somebody can prove to me that I'm wrong, I'll totally drop it, which, as JD knows, can probably be quite frustrating at times. But it does mean that you get good evidence-based opinions that eventually come out.
Okay, so we went from having no electricity on Sundays, restrictions on TV shows.
I suspect actually probably just lack of awareness that certain TV shows existed.
Yeah, which is probably for the best.
Yeah, totally. We didn't really watch a lot of TV. We had a TV, but this was the days before Sky. I mean, I remember when the day that Channel 5 came out was the most exciting day of my childhood, I think. Probably it was around for even when Channel 4 came out, which for non-UK listeners, like there were five main channels in England growing up, and then you have cable with everything else on. But cable didn't really come around until I was probably 14, 15. So we didn't have a TV when I was very young. And then when we did, it was mainly like watching videos. I remember getting a TV and getting a box with just loads of Disney films in. So yeah, probably up to 13, I didn't really watch, I guess, much TV at all beyond sort of just cartoons and fun stuff.
So then it would have been about, what, 18, 19 that you took a complete U-turn on beliefs?
Yeah, probably 19. And I just thought about this and decided I was either right or wrong and decided I was wrong. I mean, it was like, oh yeah, I'm wrong, totally changed everything, which was obviously a pretty life-altering, wow, everything that I've built my life on belief structure is wrong. Most of my friends, when I told them, like my non-Christian friends, when I told them, just thought I was joking. None of them believed it at all. But it was quite an instant, like, okay, black and white for me.
Also, growing up, you mentioned not growing up in financial abundance. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
I guess financially, we had no real money. So as I said, my dad had to stop working when I was quite young. I'm not sure the exact age, but I don't have memories of my dad walking. So it was probably like 5 or 6, somewhere around there. And so he had been doing window cleaning for years just to make some money. And then his knees just gave way from getting up at 4 a.m, I guess, to go and clean windows. And my mum decided to take 10 years off work to raise me because she decided it was more important that she was there for me than that she was bringing money in, which I guess is a interesting conversation to think about and reflect on. But that meant that we basically just sort of lived off benefits and off occasional envelopes under the door with some money in from anonymous friends, another advantage of being in a Christian community. And I guess I grew up without having much, but probably also at the same time, like, without ever expecting much. I feel like looking back, I used to have Christmases and birthdays where I just had a huge amount of presents. So I feel like for the whole of the year, my parents must have been saving like week in, week out, just so they could buy me birthday and Christmas presents. Because my birthday is in November, it probably is pretty tough because it all comes at once for them.
So were you aware of that at the time?
I don't think so. I mean, there was certainly a point where I was, yeah. So when I was 7 or 8, I think 8, for my 8th birthday, my parents got me a computer, which I think, like, probably most people got their first computer about the same time, because this was when personal computers were first becoming available in homes. It was an old Amiga for anyone that's interested. That would not have been something that had been cheap for them. So that must have been a massive amount of the benefits and the things that we were living off at that stage, I guess. So I suppose for the rest of the year, we didn't have a lot of, like, things. You know, I ate perfectly good meals and everything else. I was nutritious and healthy, but a treat would be going to the park. It wouldn't be doing something extravagant. We'd never go out the country on a holiday. We used to go for 1 week to Cornwall and stay in a friend's little caravan on a farm, and that would be our holiday. But my mum would make sure, you know, that if there were any activities that I could go to. I feel like I had a very rich childhood. I was always doing very different things, but they were always within the scope of a 30-minute bus ride from where I lived. But them saving up to do that, you know, with the computer, obviously, I started learning to program almost as soon as I got that when I was aged 8, and that very much then changed the direction of my life, because I learned that skill at that formative age where you can learn things very well and very quickly.
So imagine that you've just got a computer. Because I remember being small and just getting a computer. And my first thing was like, let's play solitaire on it, or let's play card games on it, and let's just play games on it. So what was it about a computer arriving that made you think, right, let's learn how to code?
So firstly, I'm 5 years older than you, and solitaire wasn't around back then. I'm sort of serious about that, actually. Like, when I got the Amiga, there wasn't a huge amount to do that came with it. There were a few icons on the screen, a couple of which were like basic games. And then one of those icons was like the shell icon, the command line icon. And my dad always told me I was never allowed to use that because I might break it all. And then I think to pacify him from me using that, I guess bought a sort of introduction to programming language thing for children. I mean, computers, I was born in 83, so this was probably 1990. Computers up to that stage had really been a hobbyist thing. So you got a computer and you learned to program to be able to use it. And that was the story of computers in the 70s and 80s. So I think that culture was a lot more like that then. Now you get a computer and you expect it to do everything for you in the same way, you know, you're almost not aware that your phone is a computer. It's just a few icons. But it was very different by then. So I guess I played a few games on there as well, and they would have been things like solitaire of that level. But then I was like, well, it sounds a lot more fun to make a game than it does to play it. So this also came out of the no electricity on Sunday thing, was that we weren't allowed things like TV on Sundays because of that. So when I say no electricity, we had lights, but we weren't allowed TV, we weren't allowed to use computer, I wasn't allowed to listen to the radio, anything that was sort of, I think the logic was causing people to work because the Sabbath should be a day kept aside. So Sundays were very like occupy yourself with manual things days. So I used to spend hours like playing Domino Rally, where you line like a million dominoes up and then flick them, they all around the house. But then even when I did get a computer, like if there was a game that I wanted to play, so I used to play Colonization. For people who have played Civilization, it was like the predecessor of that, the first Sid Meier game. But I used to, you know, Sunday was like my day where I could have spent the whole day playing it and I couldn't. And so I used to just write out pages and pages and pages of A4 of like the strategy I was going to play next time I got onto my computer. And I think that's sort of almost like creative, not just seeing the computer as something that absorbs your energy, but as something that is something you interact with, that you can control, that you can plan, that you can strategize around, was the thing maybe that led me to see programming a little bit like that. To the point that actually when I did my final year project at university, I didn't have a laptop. And I wrote out the whole of my final year project just on sheets of A4 paper sitting in a coffee shop each day, because I liked working for coffee shops. And then just went and typed it up later, and most of it worked. But I guess this dovetails back to the religious thing a bit, that not having that consumerist electricity thing on the Sundays, actually, as irritating as a child as you can imagine that felt, not being able to watch the World Cup final or something, it did mean that I had to get used to having a day where I had to exist in my own head and had to make my own entertainment. And I was an only child, so that was even more acute. And so I would spend days like those Sundays just writing out strategies for games, like strategies for code, things to do. And I think a lot of that led then to me probably enjoying those sides of my education as well. You know, writing essays was something that I absolutely adored doing all the way through. I still, as anyone that's ever received an email off me knows, I love writing essays. So I don't think it was, if I had children, it would be something that I would inflict on them. But at the same time, I think there was a huge amount of benefit to me that probably came out of it.
Yeah, definitely. I was just thinking about that because we've worked together on a couple of projects now, and something that always strikes me is you don't just sit at a computer and code stuff that you hope works. You'll do a lot of thinking into what happens if someone clicks that, and what happens if someone does this, and what happens if someone does something that doesn't use the system in its primary way. And I wonder if that comes from just being used to just thinking things through properly, because it's a very good skill to have that is quite rare when you can just be online all the time, you can be coding all the time.
Totally. I mean, I think of if I sit down on my laptop and I'm writing software, that's pretty much me writing up my mental notes. It's rare for me to sit down to write some code and not have already written it at the back of my mind in my head, even if it's not something I'm sort of aware I've done. I literally dream in code, which probably sounds slightly pretentious and a bit weird, but I was working last night quite late until about 1:30 in the morning because I had some stuff to do. And then I woke up like in the night just to go to the bathroom, and I literally realized that my dream had been about me needing the bathroom, but coded out in my head in a programming language. And so I think I think that had a massive effect of just that thinking and that patient thinking. I'm going to preempt a question that you might not have asked here as well, because that's just made me think. One of the things that I think when I look back on what the religious upbringing gave me more than anything is that certainly in Christianity, and I guess other sort of monotheistic religions, a big part of your whole life is about long-term thinking. Your life on earth is sort of all a preparation to get to heaven and not get to hell. And it's all about doing the best thing and becoming the best person sort of in preparation for the fact that you then have this everlasting life that comes afterwards. And I think one of the things that defines me in my own head is that I'm always a long-term thinker. I'll go through a lot of pain in the short term, and I'll put up with a lot of dissatisfaction and a lot of failure in the short term if I've got some longer term goal in mind. And I think that's very much a direct reflection of what was nailed into me day in, day out as a child, that actually doing the long-term good is more important than the short-term reward. I think that's one of the most defining legacies that's come out of that as well.
When you were growing up then, the friends that you had around you, not just the ones from church and the ones from the kind of religious stuff, but also the ones that you just met at school, what was your role within a friendship group?
My best friend, Sam, I'm very fortunate to have Sam as a friend. I went to secondary school with Sam, so we were like best friends from the age of 12. And then he was also at the same church as me. So I basically stopped going to my parents' church at the age of about 13 and a half and started going to this other church where it had a huge youth group. And so I was close to Sam in both those places. And then I guess what was quite interesting was in the church scenario, there were 100 people plus in that youth group who we were in that Christian circle with. And then at school, there was really us and maybe a couple of others who were also Christians. But in my close group of friends, it was us. And then our other close friends weren't Christians. And there was one friend, Tim, who started out in the Christian group and was also at the same church as us at school. And then he stopped being a Christian at about 16. And that was difficult for us to process at the time. I guess we spent a lot of time defining ourselves by that religion. And in the friendship group at school, we spent a lot of time debating with our non-Christian friends who were probably as strongly non-Christian as we were Christian. My A-levels were like history, philosophy, and classics, which were all quite debatey, quite digging into facts sort of things. And I shared the same group of friends, really, that we did all of those subjects together. And philosophy lessons tended to just be us on one side and them on the other, and the remaining 26 people in the class just sitting and listening while we debated things. So I think certainly that had a massive effect on me debating and me being able to argue strongly. Critical thinking, although I look back and I'm slightly embarrassed by my lack of critical thinking about some of it. But at the same time, it's quite interesting to think about. One of the interesting things with like debating societies is that they give you a point to argue, and then you have to argue that premise, regardless of whether you believe it or not. And I think the fact that I spent such a long time in life arguing very strongly for Christianity, and now I would argue very strongly against Christianity, is quite interesting in my head, that actually, I guess what I became good at was debating a point that I'd been given to debate, which is, I think, is a valuable skill to have, the truth of the matter or not aside.
Have you taken that with you into how you operate today?
As somebody that I spend time debating with on quite a regular a regular occurrence, you're aware that I am somebody that likes a challenging debating conversation. I'm someone that really seeks truth. Now, I guess that's probably really come out of me having that Christian upbringing and then changing, is that I want to make sure that if I'm doing something, it is the right thing. And I also always sort of want to seek truth in a situation more than seeking being right. I'm also somebody that, as I said earlier, the whole strong opinions loosely held, I do tend to, if I hear a good idea, attach myself to it probably way too quickly and then have to be fought down from that, which maybe is frustrating for the people. It can be good. I think in a business sense, actually, things like that can be very good in terms of you can just take something and run with it very hard, and you can be quite quick to fail. If I have an idea, I'll just run with it. And if a month later it's not working, I'm happy to dump it or throw away. Whereas I think other people would spend an awful lot of time discussing and debating before they try anything, and then would become very emotionally attached to that thing. So I think all of that has come out of that, which are good traits and bad traits, both for me and for people around me, probably.
So on the business side then, because we've talked about you being very young, getting your first computer, learning how to code, planning out what the code would look like on a Sunday when you weren't able to actually code, and then going crazy on Monday, I imagine. Yeah. Like, I can imagine like keyboards with smoke everywhere.
You can imagine me at school, incredibly frustrated, just wanting to get home so I could get to it. Yeah, exactly.
So just coding like crazy all the time then. So talk to me about the journey from that to where you are now with business stuff.
So I started coding at 8. At 14, I made and sold my first website for somebody on a, I guess, consultancy basis. Or it sounds a bit weird to be a consultant age 14. But I mean, this was sort of the birth of the popular internet. People were getting their websites for the first time. This was the age of GeoCities for anyone that's old enough to remember. So I'd sort of learned the website of things. I'd always had a real interest in artificial intelligence. I think that came from being really young, like much younger than 14, I don't know, probably even before I had a computer, where I used to desperately want to be able to make vending machines. And I'd sit in my lounge making vending machines out of cardboard boxes and being incredibly frustrated that I couldn't build the electronics behind it to be able to put money in the slot and choose something and get the right thing out. So anyway, artificial intelligence is something that really interested me, and getting computers just to think. So as I said, I did classics, history and philosophy as my A-levels. So the other side of that was always being really interested in that sort of thing as well. And I think philosophy and artificial intelligence are very closely linked, and I hope even more closely linked as we go forward, as there will become a lot of very deep philosophical questions about artificial intelligence. But I went on to do a degree in computer science and AI, and I sort of knew at that stage, I think I knew from very early age, that I wanted to run a software company and be in business. I'd always really admired Bill Gates as both the richest man in the world and also somebody who was quite philanthropic in what they were doing. And I think I wanted to emulate that. And I sort of, I guess, got a taste for it in like selling websites and stuff when I was 14. So I went, did that degree, came out, worked somewhere for 2 years, and spent a lot of that just looking for an opportunity to go and start my own business. And that opportunity came, somebody was going and starting, they were working for a division of a FTSE 100 company, so one of the biggest 100 companies in the UK. And I'd done a bit of work for them, the company I was working for, and they asked me if I would like to go and build this software system for this huge company on a consulting basis. And so I did that with a friend, and we started this company, set things up, and then out of that came another business called Meducation, which I started with another one of my friends. That was a medical education network, so teaching people to be, helping medical students learn a lot of the stuff that they would find hard to learn in maybe a classroom environment, and using technology to try and help them. So I did that for a few years. We raised some investment. I had about 15% of medical students in the world were using our platform to help learn.
I love how casually you say that as well. 15% of the world's medical students are learning medicine from my platform.
It was fun. Yeah, it was good. But that sort of got upset by YouTube. People started so YouTube didn't exist when we started what we were doing there. And then people started uploading all this content to YouTube, which actually sort of invalidated the need for a lot of what we were doing. So I left that and set up a company with some of the people I'd worked with at Meducation, that I'd hired at Meducation. And we now do joint ventures with other experts and geniuses in their fields, doing everything from, as you said in the introduction at the beginning, using AI during heart surgery to try and spot errors that doctors are making that they're not aware that they're making, to something called Exorcism, which is a platform that people can use probably just once they've got past the very basics of coding to either improve their skills, or if they're learning second or third programming languages, to practice that. That's got 200,000 people using it so far, and we're aiming to add a couple of zeros onto that in the next couple of years. There's a lot of stuff like that that really drives me in terms of, I think my mission is definitely to make the world better than how I found it. But I would like to do that on quite an ambitious scale. So, you know, if Exorcism helped 1 billion people learn how to write software so they get more opportunity in life, that would feel like the sort of target that would make me happy. A big part of what I aim for in life is to give people opportunity. I think I was fortunate because we grew up without any money. And so I didn't have access to, I guess, you know, private education or anything like that. But I was fortunate to go to a good school, to a grammar school. I know lots of people like grammar schools, lots of people very much dislike grammar schools, but it was certainly a school that I went to and received a good education. And I think having access to that sort of opportunity where I was able to be around other intelligent people and having teachers that cared about me getting a good education was hugely important. But there are billions of people in the world that just don't have that opportunity. I mean, even in the UK, you know, schools are a very mixed bunch, but in other parts of the world, there's just absolutely zero chance of getting that. So if through whatever I do, I can give people opportunities in to learn to code or to improve their health or other ways, I think that's something that resonates very deeply with my own experience in growing up, and also with the deeply rooted Christian theology that's part of my genetic makeup now of being kind and helping people and everything else.
When you were at school, are there any teachers that particularly stood out to you?
So JD and I went to the same school, but many years apart. So we didn't, when I say many years, 5 years apart. I think I was in the top year and maybe JD was in the bottom. So we didn't know each other at school. But yeah, I mean, there were a few teachers. I guess there was one teacher. So a very defining point in my life was when I was 14 and my granddad died. I have no idea particularly why, but I'd always had my granddad as quite an inspirational character. Again, he was somebody that I only knew as somebody that was retired, that sat in a chair and didn't do anything and chain smoked. But he was always, I guess, somebody that was just very kind and loving to me. I remember he had a watch, I still got it, which was given to him, I think, on the 40th anniversary or something of him working at a place. And there was just something about that that I really liked, and that sort of loyalty and everything that he had stayed in this company for that long, just doing the same thing. But anyway, he died of cancer when I was 14. It just, I don't know, it shook me. I was off school. I think I was off school for about 8 weeks in total. I just had this migraine that wouldn't go. I think probably looking back, I was just a bit in shock, a bit depressed, a bit confused. And also, you know, teenage hormones as well that just make everything 10 times worse. But I'd been off school for about 8 weeks. And I think I probably had my parents around my little finger a little bit. And I was like, I'm just not going back to school. And they just had no way of persuading me otherwise. Until one day, Mr. Marston, he was my class prefect, class teacher, whatever you call them.
Form teacher,
thank you. Yeah, my form teacher. So that was like the form that you would do registration with in the morning. So I guess he was responsible for my well-being, but I think, I'm sure it was agreed, but he just rocked my house and basically told me I was coming to school the next day. In a incredibly, you're doing this, but also very like, it's going to be fine, don't sweat it way. And I got to school and it was fine. And nobody asked me about it and nobody had talked to me about it. And I probably wasn't aware at the time, but looking back, I can see the iron fist of him having told anyone that if they make my life hard, it would not be pleasant for them. But he was somebody that I massively respected. And I think that was probably quite a momentous point in my life where I probably could have gone in multiple directions, but he was very, very strong and wise in the way he approached that. And he was like that all through my school and to a lot of people. So he's probably the person that I guess stands out the most.
Yeah, he was definitely one of my favorite teachers as well. Shout out to Mr. Marston, yes, if you are listening. On your working journey then, because if you were 14 when you were first setting up something and doing it commercially, do you remember how you learn how to do the commercial side of it? Because I think it's one thing learning how to code and learning how to do that, but then actually learning how to get a customer and sign them up and, like, I don't know, raise an invoice and all that stuff. Where did you learn all that?
So the person who I first made a website for was like one of my parents' friends from church. So I guess all that bit was nice and easy. But it was, I mean, this was really the generation of 14-year-olds were the only people who knew how to make websites. So everyone wanted a smart teenager that could help them with that. I think the first commercial experience was probably when I was 17. And in one of the summers, we got an office in the custard factory in Birmingham with me and two friends. We basically just went around every company in the custard factory, persuading them that we were the perfect people to make a website for them. And we signed up a modeling agency, of all things. The one thing we didn't have were any design skills. So a modeling agency was like the worst possible client for us. But we succeeded in making them a reasonable website and getting paid for it. So I have a strange approach to the commercial world, which is I have zero contracts with anybody. Everything is just done on a handshake. Everything's done on trust and on, I guess, just belief and honesty. I always feel like if somebody is somebody that I feel like I need to have a contract with, then I definitely don't want to go into business with them. And if I get burnt from that, then so be it. And so I guess I had dozens and dozens of customers over the last few years. And I think almost none of them have had that formal relationship, even when sometimes they'd be paying, you know, £150,000, £200,000 for bits of software. And so, well, a lot of people, I guess, look at the business side of things and take, you know, the Harvard Business Review style approach to things or an MBA style approach to things of seeing business in that way. I just see business very much as relationships and as trying to be honest and doing a good job for people. And that's held me in good stead so far. And I think given me a reputation through word of mouth as well, where I've never advertised for work. It's all come through word of mouth. It's all come from people who recommend me to other people. And there's been a lot of stuff that we've done as well that's been like B2C or B2B online selling. So that is totally different because that's just a game. That's just put your products out in a marketing way that people will buy and then, you know, give them a good service when they do it. It's like the totally opposite end of the sort of relationship scale. And so I think on that side of things, that's just a strategy. And I'm a strategist. That's my favorite thing to do, is to strategize. So you just work out a strategy of how you can create something to sign people up and then put tactics in around doing that better and better. So I guess I don't feel like I've ever learned commercial skills in that way. I read an awful lot and I'm somebody that is quick to fail and quick to learn from those failures and will just put myself out there and try things rather than being afraid of, I guess, getting things wrong.
So not really where you learned how to be commercial yourself, but do you remember when you were younger having an impression of work from anywhere else? Like, do you remember forming opinions on what work was?
No. And I'm somebody that has a very different impression of what work is to everyone else. So my teams in the various businesses that I run are all remote. We don't sit in an office. We don't keep working hours. People drop in and drop out online as they see fit. People take holidays if they want to take holidays and just put it in a calendar. I very much have the attitude for work that your life should be something that you enjoy living and that you should be trying to do something that feels meaningful and satisfying to you. And you're going to spend most of your non-sleeping life in work, in inverted commas. So I'm very strict that I want the people who work for me or work with me to be living their lives and enjoying it day to day. And I think the people that choose to work for me probably do so largely because of that. You know, one of the guys, a guy called Doug, I think one of the things he really likes, he's a semi-professional mountain biker, and he knows that if it's sunny outside, he'll just drop in online and just say, I'm disappearing for 4 hours, see you later. And I think that freedom is something that those people appreciate. But I don't really know where that comes from, other than I think people should have the right to do what they want in life generally. But I do think maybe it does come from not having that preconceived idea of what work was. And probably for the first 10 years, not seeing either of my parents working, but sort of knowing my dad had been out there like doing the window cleaning stuff to try and bring some money in. I never would consider my parents in any way to be lazy, but I probably didn't get that idea of my parents go out to a 9-to-5 job and then come back, which I guess most people is what it's like in their childhood.
So maybe having that blank canvas meant that you could create your own version of it rather than start from a definition, like you said.
Yeah, I think so. And I think as well, because I'm good at what I do, I've got a lot of choice in, I could work, you know, for a lot of companies doing a lot of things and have that freedom to make those decisions about finding a workplace that I would very much enjoy. And because instead I'm sort of choosing to run my own things, I feel very strongly that I want everyone else to have that opportunity. So one of my team, Charles, who's worked with me for the last, getting on for 5 years probably now, I think one of the things that he really loves about working with me is that he knows that he can be flexible for his kids. He can do nursery runs. He can do pickups. He can always be available for whatever needs to happen and have that high degree of flexibility. And I like that I can give his kids that opportunity to spend time with their parents as well, which I think many businesses unnecessarily deprive people of that. Because I don't think that, I get very passionate about this and talk for hours, but I don't think that 9 to 5, 5 day a week working thing is in any way a sensible, productive way to run a business unless you have a factory style approach or maybe a shop that you need to do. I mean, JD and I have traveled to lots of places and we both work harder than most people I know, but we also have a high degree of flexibility and freedom in what we do, and we both value that. I hope I'm not putting words into your mouth, but I think understanding that you can work hard and you can be really driven and you can really try and achieve things, but also that you only do get to live your life once and that you want to make the most of every single day in the way that feels best to make the most of that day is something that's important to me and therefore something that I want to give out to others. And that's probably a mixture of the Christian upbringing of wanting the best for everyone else around me, and also a mixture of, like you say, that blank slate where I didn't see a lot of that in my parents growing up.
One of the books that I think we've both read that I learned quite a lot about that style of stuff is the 4-Hour Work Week. And I really like that it's not just for people who are running their own companies and want to do it very flexibly or from all over the world, but it's also a blueprint for people who are working within companies, how they can earn the trust and then put the framework in place for them to be able to have the flexibility as well. And it sounds like, I mean, I don't know if that book influenced it at all, but like it sounds like that's what your team around you are doing, earning the trust to be able to do that.
Yeah, totally. So I've never read that book because I find the title obnoxious.
But I think I've judged it unnecessarily.
But yeah, 100%. So, and I guess this gets into the area of business, but we focus very hard on hiring people for their personalities and their attitudes. That's probably the number one thing that matters to anyone that we hire. And so far, pretty much every single person we've hired has been brilliant because they've, like you say, they want to earn that trust, but they also they value being in a company that just wants to give them that freedom. And so actually I think they enjoy it. I think everyone, I really hope everyone would say this, but I think everyone that works with us just feels like they're on a journey together and we're all in it together and we're all having fun together. And so we have a couple of people that work for us in the Philippines. They're just some of the most hardworking, brilliant, intelligent, just lovely people. And one of them I've never met in real life. The other one I've met a couple of times and is equally lovely in real life. But I could go for years without meeting them and our only communications could just be typing online. We don't even do video calls. We just type. But they earn my trust without ever feeling like I hope, need to earn it, because it's just a culture where we're all in it together. And that's something I think is really important.
Where would you say your confidence comes from? Because I don't, just to caveat this a little bit, I think you'd call yourself a confident person, but I don't think you'd call yourself a kind of outward, like you wouldn't be over the top about being excited about something.
I'm a miser.
Because I know you've done like talks and conferences and being in front of a lot of people talking about stuff that you're really passionate about, the kind of confidence to be able to do that. Can you think of what in your like childhood has given you that confidence?
My mum was very focused on making sure I was exposed to as many things as possible. That was a really big part of how she wanted to do parenting. I'm an only child and a pretty extreme introvert. So just to define introvert properly here, I get a lot of energy when I'm sitting by myself reading or doing whatever. Hanging out with more than one or two people is very, very draining for me. And I think if you look back at my stories that my mom could tell when I was young, I would go to a place where there'd be lots of other kids or children there, and I would sit back in the corner and just watch them and just observe the whole thing for a very long time before I'd get involved. And I think I got exposed to a lot. And I think I'm somebody who tries to be thoughtful and have probably had that built into me from that very young age of watching, observing, and then being decisive when I decided to do something. I have very strong sense of self-belief.
Is that a cockroach?
Yeah, it's a massive cockroach.
Oh my God!
Just by me. But it's good. It's fine. It's fine. It's,
what do we do?
We're in... it's flying. So we're in Austin right now, which the only place I've seen cockroaches is in Jodie's flat. But we were in Bali last year for some time, and that place was full of cockroaches, and it was scary. I'm good if you're good.
Yeah, fine.
Jodie's sort of on tiptoes, ready to just pounce, but it's nearer me. I'm good. So yeah, I have this very inbuilt sense of confidence that I don't know where it comes from. I'm very confident in my intelligence, and I'm very confident that you can put me in any situation and I'll be very quick to understand something and very quick to be able to communicate that clearly, which I guess just gives me a sense of being able to get out of any trouble I get myself into. I guess the Christian thing has a big effect because it's not about winning, it's about doing the right thing. So I was never taught, you know, there was never any focus on materialism for me growing up. There was never any expectation of, you know, I'd be successful if I was rich, or I would be successful if I ran a company, or I'd be successful if I was a doctor. I would be successful if I just tried to do the right things and tried to be a good person. And that was what was, I guess, burnt into me day by day. So I think that then has probably influenced my confidence a lot, because as long as I feel like I'm doing the right thing for the right reasons, I'll just go and do it. And I then have the confidence in my intelligence to say, if it does go wrong, I can probably blag my way out of it. So if you put me on stage, if I feel like I've got a message to tell in that conference talk or whatever, I'll go out there with confidence that I'm doing the right thing by telling it, knowing that if it all does go horribly wrong, I'll probably be able to talk my way out of it.
So the formula then for how you were created as a useful person, go.
I'm going to trust my mom in that she would say being exposed to lots and lots and lots of things was really important, because it let me find what it was that I enjoyed and was good at. I think a focus on encouraging me to do what I loved and what I was interested in, and on doing things for the right reasons rather than a focus on the outcomes. Never failure, never mattering. It just mattering that I was trying, and I was trying my best, and I was trying to do good things. A lot of love. I'm sure, you know, I always felt very loved and very safe at home. But I think a life philosophy in terms of religion that I probably strongly disagree with, a total lack of money, and a lack of a lot of goods, which are the things that often the whole world strives to give their children. I guess I got time off my mom. She chose to be with me for the first 10 years of my life rather than choosing to earn some money so she could be comfortable, which is something that will have had a massive influence. So I would say the formula would probably just be that middle bit more than anything. It would be about encouraging a child to do what they find interesting and what they love without a fear of failure, without a need for some massive success at the end of it. And just a confidence that if they're enjoying it and they're trying their best in it, that's enough. And then that child will find something that child loves, which for me has been business and software, and they'll find a motivation to do it, which for me is about leaving the world a little bit better than I found it. And then from there, you don't need a lot else to make you feel content. That's enough to get up in the morning and go and do stuff and then go to sleep at night feeling like it's been a good day.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find out more about you?
Everywhere online, I'm known as IHID, IHID.
Which
stands for something you have to be a good friend of mine to know. So if you can follow me on Twitter, my handle is IHID, or you can go to my website, which is ihid.co.uk, and either of those, say hello to me and I would love to say hello back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode was brought to you by Clever Tykes Children's Storybooks. If you want to support the podcast and help share our ethos of inspiring, enterprising behaviour, head over to clevertykes.com and order a set of the storybooks to give to a child that you know.